Hello and welcome back to the Pathology Grand Tour. I'm Liv Gaskill and today our tour bus stops at Paediatric and Perinatal Pathology. We're joined by Oscar Lopez Nunez, who is Assistant Professor at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, and Miguel Reyes Mujica, who is Chief of the Division of Paediatric Pathology at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. Oscar and Miguel are here to share a day in their lives with us, tell us about their journey into the lab, and take a look at what lies ahead for paediatric and perinatal pathology.
Thank you both for joining us today. We really appreciate you giving us your time to speak to us. Just to get us started, can you each tell us a bit about yourself and your role? Oscar, should we start with you?
Sure. Well, thank you for the opportunity. I'm not originally from here. I was born and raised in El Salvador, Central America. So I decided to pursue medicine and I completed my medical training back there. So with my wife as well, she's also a physician. And we graduated back in 2012. So by then we knew that we wanted to do additional training in the US and that was our goal. So we decided to stay a little bit longer back home for about a year. I think the purpose was try to, you know, figure out some logistics and save some money and, you know, so on and so forth. So during that time, I worked in medical education as an assistant professor in my med school in the Department of Public Health. But by the end of that period of time, we made a decision. We wanted to emigrate to the US and we came here as students, actually. So we landed in Chicago in 2013 and we lived there for 2 years. And that's essentially the time that took us to prepare for the USMLEs. As you might know, those are the requirements that you need to fulfill in order to apply for a residency training. So to be quite honest with you, I was not thinking of doing pathology when all that happened. When I came to the US, my thinking was I'm probably going to apply into internal medicine and into internal medicine program. But that period of time is actually what changed my mind, because I think the fact that I had to go back to basic sciences and prepare for my step one, it sort of opened my eyes, because all of a sudden I could understand many things that I'm not very aware of when I was practicing general medicine. It's like pathology gave me answers to my questions, sort of speak. And I became very interested in that, you know. So I realized that I was more interested also in the diagnostic portion of the disease, of the medicine, that actually than in the treatment portion. So it was not a straightforward process. It actually was a very cumbersome process for me. And I thought many times, I don't know if I'm going to the right direction. So I figured out the best way to do this is to have a full immersive experience into what it takes to be a pathologist. So I managed to find a couple opportunities as an observer in two different programs. So I went to a program in Chicago and the other one in Lexington, Kentucky. And I think I spent over 4 months probably shadowing residents, shadowing attending pathologists, just having a sense of what it really takes to be a pathologist in the US as well. And after that period of time, I was convinced that this is what I wanted to do. So it was a gradual conversion process. But I made my mind and I decided to apply to residency programs in the US. I follow all the interviewing process. I match at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center program. So I completed a combined track in anatomic and clinical pathology and followed by a subspecialty training in pediatric pathology at UPMC Children's, where I had the opportunity to work and train under Miguel's watch. And after that, I relocated to Cincinnati. So in the midst of the pandemic, I moved there and I've been working there for a while now as an assistant professor, and recently became appointed as an associate fellowship program director as well. So I'm very excited about that because I'm really interested in medical education.
Nice. And Miguel, what about you?
Well, my path through here was a little bit similar to Oscar's in a way, because I'm also a foreigner by birth, but I am an American by naturalization. I never planned to stay here. I never wanted to stay here as a primary option. I applied to a fellowship when I was a resident of pathology in Mexico. And I wanted to do forensic pathology because for a family connection that I had in the Mexican government, it sounded like a very good opportunity. And I have always been interested in forensics. But that didn't work out because they asked me to repeat my entire residency. And I wasn't willing to do that, to repeat my residency in this country. So I canceled my USMLE steps. At that time, they were called differently. And went back, finished my residency, enter a year of enter a period of practicing as an attending pediatric pathologist. My residency in Mexico was very complete because I spent several years before the residency doing pathology. I did 40 autopsies before being a resident of pathology, just as a scholar, if you will. And I work under one of the most prominent pathologists in the world, in particular in the research world, Dr. Perez Tamayo, who is still a good friend and guides me through every Saturday. We have conversations. He's almost 97 years old. So I'm now a professor, tenured at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. I'm also the chief of pathology and head of laboratories at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. And I was, before coming, a professor of pathology and pediatrics at Yale University, where I was recruited and started the program of Yale Pediatric and Developmental Pathology program. I directed that program for 14 years, and then I was recruited here. How did I come after not planning to be here? It's interesting because there was a meeting in Mexico that brought together a number of people. And one of them was a former colleague of mine in residency in Mexico who was spending some time in Canada. She had moved to Canada. And she invited me to visit with her for a couple of weeks. So I went very excited to tell Dr. Perez Tamayo, and this is after I canceled my USMLEs. And he said, if you're going to leave, don't go to a small town. Go where the sharks are. So he wrote a letter to Dr. Francisco Gonzalez Cruci, a giant and a founder of pediatric pathology. And the next weekend, I got a phone call at home. And when I answered, he said, Dr. Reyes, yes, this is Dr. Gonzalez Cruci. If Dr. Perez Tamayo recommends you, you're accepted. So I ended up going for 1 year to Chicago with my late wife. She was a resident in dermatology. And we spent a full year there. I was doing a lot of neuropathology, pediatric, and I took care of the tumor board in brain tumors. And finally, both of us, my wife, late wife, and I, received invitations to stay for a year, extra year. That caused a problem because when my children said that they wanted to stay, we came with my three children from my first marriage. They wanted to stay for a second year, but the family in Mexico, their mother and her family, didn't want us to stay. So when we sent them for vacation, they kidnapped them, and they kept them against the law and against my will and my children's will. So I had to go, and it was a nightmare, but I finally brought them in, and Dr. Gonzalez Cruci, having gone through not exactly the same, but a similar problematic situation with three children and a first wife, sort of took some pity on me, I guess. And he said, well, if you take the tests, the steps, and you pass them, I'll give you a fellowship here. I had already spent a year and a few months. And then, so I registered for the steps. I took them all in one shot on Monday, step one, on Tuesday, step two. Step three, a couple months later in Philadelphia, fortunately passed, and I got a fellowship at Children's Memorial Hospital, now Lurie Children's Hospital. And from then on, you know, things evolved. I was hired at Yale, and they allowed me to receive credit for sitting for the American Board of Pathology, which I did, and then for the Pediatric Pathology Boards, which I did. So I'm fully boarded, if you will. But my arrival here was a little complicated. Never went back.
So then, Miguel, what made you specifically choose pediatrics? What set out the field apart from other pathology subspecialties?
Well, pediatric pathology is the widest type of pathology that you can practice as a subspecialist. In all other fields, you have to give some areas, you have to give up some areas. While in pediatric pathology, you just concentrate in the pediatric age group, which is now from prenatal patients all the way up to 26 years of age. In pediatric pathology, the key word is development. Studying development, you quickly realize that the same mechanisms that developing tissues use to grow and become what they are used by neoplastic tissues. These are your biological mechanisms, except that the neoplastic tissues break homeostasis and sometimes kill you. So understanding development, you may also be able to understand neoplasia, which is at the center of the study of pathology. And there is also the issue that there are many fascinating developmental conditions in pediatric pathology. Take, for example, Hirschsprung disease. You know, it's a relatively common neural crest disorder, neurocrestopathy. And I have become a neurocrestomaniac since my first publication in Mexico. When I was a medical student, there was a competition and we won first prize for a review on neuroblastoma, which is, you know, the first thing I ever published. So since then, my passion for the neural crest has remained as the focus of my academic interest. Therefore, you know, I am a pediatric pathologist and I fully enjoy it.
So Oscar, what about you? What made you specifically choose pediatrics?
I felt that that's a very interesting question for me because I think it was a combination of factors that helped me to make that decision. I think that probably the most important factor was the fact that I was exposed to pediatric pathology very early in my training. So I started my residency in 2015 in July. And by the end of that year, which was essentially November, December, I was already rotating through the pediatric pathology division. So I think that gave me a very interesting perspective because at that time I was able, you know, to compare how the dynamics in the adult service is and contrast that with the dynamics in the pediatric service. So that was definitely helpful. But of course, the decision is more complex than that. It was also personal preference. So I like the versatility that comes with pediatric pathology, to put it that way. I cannot see myself limiting my practice to an organ system. And I just don't think that there's anything wrong with that. It's just like it doesn't work well for me. So just to put specific examples, in pediatric pathology, for instance, you develop expertise in the autopsy service because sometimes you just have to perform your own autopsy cases. And even within the autopsy service, it's a broad spectrum of cases you're going to see, from perinatal cases, you know, to older children. So that's one example. But at the same time, you get exposed to allografts, transplant pathology, to liver pathology, to metabolic conditions, to pediatric oncologic diseases, which in my opinion is one of the most interesting parts. And there are specific neoplasms that are germane to pediatric age groups. So I think that broad spectrum of entities that you get to see in pediatric pathology is one of the things that really attract me. And of course, that goes to the point that Miguel was making as well, the developmental aspect of the disease. I think that's something that is intrinsically related to our training as a subspecialty that set us apart from other fields in pathology. And the perinatal and the placental component as well is an important part. It's not probably my main area of interest, but I'm quite comfortable with it. And I feel that perinatal and placental pathology is something that is underappreciated in the rest of the pathology world. So yes, I will say that it's because pediatric pathology offers great versatility And but particularly going back to my original point, probably what actually catalyzed my decision was the fact that I was able to experience all that early in my career.
Nice. And then starting with you, Miguel, could you take us through a day in your life as a pediatric pathologist?
Sure. Before I start with that, I should mention that the change of rotation in our system is, I take credit for that, because usually residents used to rotate late in their residency training, and I pushed my idea of making them rotate early so that Oscar and others embrace pediatric pathology. And we had a string of excellent people rotating with us that became pediatric pathologists or pediatric pathology fellows. So that was a good idea, I think. So a day in my life, yes. Well, I wear many hats. I am a diagnostician. I am a research scientist. I am a professor and an administrator at the same time. So as a diagnostician, I review cases from the pediatric population of a hospital, consults from different parts of the world, routine cases that, you know, are exceptional, and many other really difficult, exceptional cases that come from people that are experienced but don't know a particular question. So my interest concentrate right now in neural crest disorders, as I mentioned, in particular congenital melanocytic proliferations, such as giant congenital nevi and associated disorders, neurocutaneous melanocytosis, for example, and congenital melanoma. I may be the person that has seen the largest number of neurocutaneous melanocytosis cases in the world. And I receive, you know, the trick to become an expert is that you declare yourself an expert, and then people believe you, and then they send you cases, and then you become an expert for real. So that happened with me, and have to declare that experience is just the name that we gave to our mistakes, according to Oscar Wilde, right? So I have a large volume of consultations of that type of disorder, and also of pediatric pathology, because I spent a sabbatical period in Madrid studying only pediatric testicular pathology, or mainly pediatric testicular pathology. So I have written a lot about that, and I received that as a diagnostician. That's my part. And this made me also enter the world of the blue books in the WHO classification. Now I was appointed expert editor of the most senior expert editor of the blue book that is coming out in a few months. And I took care of several of the sections that are related to my areas of expertise, including testicular pathology. As a research scientist, I have an experimental research lab. We study neural crest disorders. We have mice. We are developing a mouse model for the disease. So we have to apply for funding. We have to, you know, write grants, etc. And that comes around with my interest in neural crest abnormalities. But I also carry research in other conditions, including, you know, transplant pathology, Hirschsprung disease, even dermatopathology, pediatric dermatopathology. As a professor, and a professor is defined by the Oxford English Dictionary as a university academic of the highest rank, so I try to mentor and educate people around me, trainees, faculty members at different levels of development. I give multiple conferences in, you know, now virtual platforms are becoming really very, very popular, and I hate them, but because I like to travel. But I have given about 8 in this year, and I still have 4 or 5 more programmed. So I have formed numerous trainees that have achieved high levels of success. They have become professors at Yale, Harvard, Stanford, etc. And I have also served as director of education technology for the International Pediatric Pathology Association, and that's another very active teaching task that I performed. And I am, as I mentioned, a frequent speaker at international academic events. The last one was yesterday at 4 a.m. for the European Congress of Pathology. And the most popular one was about 3 weeks ago with PATH Presenter that had 7,100 people attending. And finally, as an administrator, I oversee a relatively large group of people, about 110-120 people in my general division. I hold a CLIA license for the lab. So I try to be compliant with all the policies, updating policies, etc. I supervise all my group. I have five additional pathologists in my group, but I have about 25 other pathologists in other divisions that I also oversee their privileges and interact with, because they are ancillary people to our group. So our division is really very large. So those are really my tasks, and it depends in a given day. It depends what comes at hand, switching from one role to the other and sometimes making them overlap. As I frequently say, my life is a continuous change of interruptions disguised as priorities.
Sounds very varied. So what about you, Oscar? Can you take us through a day in your life?
Yeah, sure. you know, people know me, they know that I'm an early bird, so I just really like to start my day very early in the morning. So usually my day, you know, like a regular conventional day, is going to start by doing some exercise. I usually have a morning run, and whether if I decide to do it outside or inside the house, it really depends on the weather condition. But I like to be consistent with that, because I think that helps me to keep my own sanity. And after that, was I get ready, drive to work, and I usually like to be there by 6 a.m. Nobody's actually forcing me to be there. It's just like, it's my personal preference. And I think this block, you know, this period of time between 6 and 8, to me is very important, because it really helps me to focus in tasks or tasks that requires a lot of my attention. So this might be the time of the day in which I will be dealing with a challenging case. You know, this might be the time of the day in which I will be working on outstanding cases from the day before that I was not able to sign up because maybe I was too tired. This might be the time of the day I will be preparing for a presentation. And whenever off service, this might be the time of the day I will be writing manuscript or doing research activities or administrative work. So to me, it's quite important block of time, because it allows me to focus without interruptions and to get things done, at least some things done. So officially, my day starts at 8 a.m. And typically, we will have some sort of academic activity related to our fellowship program. So that will take probably one more hour. I get till 9. I usually have my morning coffee and just start to going through the pile of cases for the day. So I like to triage my cases. Because it just gives me a better sense of what's coming for the rest of the day. And of course, you don't get all the cases at once, but I try to do this as much as I can. At least I can prioritize which ones require more attention, which ones are more urgent, which ones will probably require additional workup, which ones are not that urgent that I can take care of later. And then I just start working through my cases. So I rely heavily on speech recognition software on my daily practice. Meaning that I dictate and create my own reports as I review the slides. So it's not like I don't like my transcriptionists. They actually do a great job, but I just find this is more time efficient for me. So I try to do that as much as I can. If I can sign out the case right away, I will do it. Of course, that is not always the case. There are cases that will require additional workup. There are cases that will require, you know, an opinion from another colleague. But I try to go that way. So my morning usually goes that way until I get to noon. So noontime to me is my lunch break. I usually have lunch at my office. This is the time I usually am going to just check my social media account, you know, like see, you know, what my friends in Twitter have posted and maybe posted some educational content. So it's break time for me. I resume usually around 1, and then I just keep going till the maybe 5:30. But of course, if you already work in a large academic center, as Miguel mentioned, you know that your life is more complex like that because you're going to be interrupted continuously due to various reasons. It really depends on which service work are you doing as well. Let's say you are covering rapids, then you will be constantly interrupted from the frozen section room because there might be interrupts that you need to do. Let's say you are covering autopsies. I might actually be down in the morgue for most of my morning or afternoon working on an autopsy. Let's say I'm covering surgicals. which are more routine specimens, I might be, I get calls from the cross room because I need to go and review specimens with my PAs. But of course, if you are in an academic setting, also there are academic activities, there are meetings throughout the day. So you might be in tumor boards, you might have QA sessions, you might have research meetings, faculty meetings, administrative meetings, interviews. So all that stuff is part of your day. And at the very beginning, when you are just starting, it might look a little bit overwhelming, but the more you do it, the more you learn to manage your time. So in a conventional day, I will say my main goal is try to be done by 5:30. But most of the times, that's not going to be the case, especially when you have a very busy day. Probably I had to keep just going afterwards. But regardless how busy my week is, regardless of the rotation I am, my golden rule is to stay away from the office over the weekend. So, and I really try to stick to that because I think it's helpful for your wellness. It's helpful for my family as well. So that's the approach I usually follow. If I able to leave work before 6, then I would just go back home. I might actually pick up my son's school, have dinner with my family, and then just try to go to bed before 10, so I'm able to wake up early next day in the morning. So that probably would be the way I would describe my typical day at work.
So you talked about family briefly there. You've expressed online as well that being a father makes you a better pediatric pathologist. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I think, you know, the answer to this is basically based on the fact that parenting makes you more empathetic about your patients and their families. I think it's just as simple as that. You are able to relate better, I think, to the struggles that family actually is going on or going through. So I think that's part of the reason why I feel my own experiences have actually helped me to become a better diagnostician and pathologist. But the problem is that you need to learn as well how to balance those thoughts and those feelings. And I just give you an example because I remember this very vividly when I started my training as a first year and I had an encounter, my first pediatric autopsy case. My son was probably 2 years old at that time. And my very first pediatric autopsy case was a little boy around the same age. So I clearly remember how much I struggled that first time, you know, because you cannot go away and you cannot avoid the fact that you are visualizing that family and understanding what they're going through. So it took me a while during training just to get used to that. But I think once you get to the point in which you are able to balance your empathy, then your thoughts and your feelings can be translating something really useful for your patients. And I think once you get to that point, you become a better physician and you become a better pathologist.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a really nice way of viewing it. So then from both of you, what does being a pediatric pathologist mean to you? Miguel, we'll start with you.
So what does it mean to be a pediatric pathologist for me? Well, it means that I am able to work on diseases that affect our youngest members in the human civilization. Diseases in children result in many years of productive and unhappy life lost. And that is many more years than adult disease. It also means that I can go through almost any terrain. A friend of mine and former colleague that hired me at Yale, Dr. Jose Costa, who is professor emeritus now, and was head of anatomic pathology, used to joke with me. And he said, the pediatric pathologist is like an all-wheel drive vehicle that can go through any terrain. And, you know, it is true, but it also means to me that I have the ability to interact with many parents. I do almost daily speak with parents, even at the clinical front, because they have questions about something that went through my department or in my research front. Many parents have expressed to me their gratitude for our research lab efforts. Some have, more than a few, donated significant amounts of money to our research. And a couple have expressed that although they have not met me personally, they have said, like, you are the best doctor I have ever interacted with. That really fills your soul with, you know, gratitude. That happens sometime after a late phone call, speaking to a mother, explaining to her that the lesion in her two-year-old is a melanoma and needs a particular type of treatment. So in short, pediatric pathology means to me that I am helping directly children and their families. That's the meaning.
And you, Oscar?
Yeah, to me, pediatric pathology, first, is a privilege, of course, but I think it's, it comes with a huge responsibility. And I think that's probably the most important aspect that I want to highlight, because being a pediatric pathologist means that you can make a huge difference in children that still have a life to be lived to the fullest. You know, I mean, it's not that I'm disregarding the role of other subspecialties, but I think particularly in the pediatric patient, the implications and the ramifications of your diagnosis are quite relevant, quite determinant. And I take that responsibility very seriously.
So just quickly jumping back then, from my understanding at least, so do you find that pediatric pathologists have more contact with the patients and their families compared to other subspecialties of pathology?
Is it for me?
Yeah, for either, because Miguel, you were saying how, you know, you often speak to parents and families of patients, whereas other pathologists that I may have spoken to in the past have maybe less exposure and less interaction with the with patients and all their families. Do you find that pediatric pathology has more of that exposure?
Well, if I may, I think that pathology has evolved for about 500 years. And that's why it's the really the base of modern medicine since autopsies began. But pathologists didn't start as pathologists. They were doctors that were trying to understand what happened with their patients. In that sense, they were interacting with patients much more frequently than we do now. In general, pathologists are misconceived as aloof people in the dungeon. And pediatric pathologists don't escape that particular misconception. But pediatric pathologists, because they deal with the acuteness of life, be that at birth in perinatal pathology, or be that by children that are severely sick very early in their lives, we have frequently to deal with parents, or at least I have made an effort to deal with parents, to explain to parents, to come to them and explain to them what is happening and how we can help. So I believe that, yes, the pediatric pathology offers that opportunity of interaction with families. Cytopathologists that go and do final aspirations or things of that sort are also exposed to patients, but that's a procedure that you are performing. We are not talking about procedural interactions. We are talking about true advice, professional advice and discussion. And that, I think that pediatric pathologists is privileged to have the opportunity to do that more frequently than other subspecialties.
And then finally, I just wanted to ask you, what advice would you give to people following in both your footsteps, really, who want to specialize in pediatric pathology?
Yeah, I think curriculum is important. And I briefly touched about this before during this interview, but I think that if your pathology training program has this rotation schedule as a part of the core curriculum, I would encourage you as a trainee to take a full advantage of that if you are actually considering going into pediatric pathology. As I said before, it has to be a full immersive process for you to get a real sense of what do we do in our daily practice and the importance and the meaning of our actions or diagnosis. So I think that's one thing. If you don't have the opportunity to rotate, because probably you don't have a pediatric pathology division closer, there are always opportunities for elective time. And I would encourage you to seek for that opportunity as well, because having the chance to rotate through directed experience in pediatric pathology is what actually gives you perspective for your future. So that will be one thing. The second thing will be SPP. It stands for Society for Pediatric Pathology. This is a great organization that provides very important insight into what we do as a group as well and as a field. So I would encourage trainees that have interest in getting into pediatric pathology to become junior members of the SPP. I think that has many advantages, and you can take full advantage of different awards that the SPP has established that are geared toward medical students, towards residents. There is a resident recruitment award. There is a case report award. There's also a visiting student award. So all these awards can be helpful for you to have a better experience and better understanding of what we do. So I will encourage you to seek for those opportunities as well. The third point I would think is social media. And you know, social media can be a double-edged sword, but when you use social media wisely, I think you can take full advantage of that. We have a very amazing community in Twitter, for instance. You will find amazing educational content there. You will find opportunities to interact and engage with pediatric pathologists, not only pediatric pathologists, other pathologists as well. So I think that can give you a better perspective as well, can give you the opportunity to network. So if you are considering PEDS as an option, get into social media and check it out, because I think it's very helpful. And then probably the other aspect I will say is mentorship. Mentorship is always key. The earlier, the better. Not all mentorship relationships are going to work. So you have to be persistent. You have to take the lead. You have to push your mentor, but also make sure that your mentor is someone that is really interested in your professional work and your professional growth. So I encourage you to seek for those opportunities. And this is not exclusive for pediatric pathologists, for pathology in general and medicine in general.
That's some great advice. And you, Miguel?
Sure. I have a couple of words of advice. One is curiosity. You need to feed your curiosity as much as possible. Don't get dismayed or shocked by something that you do not understand. If you don't understand something, try to penetrate it. Be consistent. Nothing resists the absolutely corrosive action of consistent work. So consistency is extremely important. Don't stop at descriptions. Go for the next item, that is, understand the disease. And don't take anything that is written as a true knowledge. Question it. I mean, we take for granted many things that are written. Most of what is written in medicine is going to change in the next few years, most of it. So take part of that change. Don't be an observer, be a mover. Don't be a follower, be a leader. So if you see something that doesn't make too much sense, just go and work on it. Learn new skills. Diagnosing is nice, but other skills are necessary to understand medicine and be a good physician. And that includes research, real research, mechanistic research. That's my advice for general things. For pediatric pathology, I think that you need to dig into developmental issues, including a rotation in perinatal, placental, and early childhood disorders, because those are extremely difficult. And a lot of general surgical pathologists and general anatomic pathologists do not have the appropriate training to deal with them, help them. So those are the general advices that I could provide to become a pediatric pathologist.
Nice. Well, that was a nice way to end it off. Thank you again, both of you, for joining us today. I feel like That was a really nice conversation and a lot there for listeners to take away from.
Thank you, Liv, for the opportunity. And it's great to see you, Miguel.
Well, thank you, Liv, and your team for the honor of inviting me to this session. It was great to exchange with you, learn from Oscar. I learned from all people, young and old, and I have learned today. So thank you for this.